Welcome to Torah Rimecha Nach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Rachel Kosowski, and today we will be studying Megillat Esther Perek Vav, Chapter 6. Yesterday in Perek Hey, Chapter 5, we learned about Esther working to lay the groundwork to save the Jewish people by creating a scenario in which she could supplant Haman as the primary influence over Ahasuerus, who is the one in power in the Persian Empire. We saw her playing the dangerous game of trying to make Ahasuerus jealous of Haman, specifically by implying that something might be going on between her and Haman. Haman is unsuspecting of Esther's plan and is flattered by her attention. He is obsessed with his hatred of Mordechai and happily follows the advice of his wife and loved ones to construct a 50 amot high post to hang Mordechai. With Chapter 6, we have reached the climax of our story. When read publicly, the first words of this chapter are read in a dramatic tone. Balaila hahu nadada shenat ha-melech. That night, the king's sleep wandered away from him. The verse continues, Vayomer l'havi et sefer ha-zechronot divrei hayamim v'yu nikraim l'fanav. He said to bring the Book of Memories, Chronicles, to be read before him. As we've been learning Megillat Esther, we've noticed the palpable absence of Shem Hashem, the name of God, in the Megillah, and the different ways the role of Hashem is nonetheless manifest as the story unfolds. In a collection called Midrash Abba Gurion al Esther, in Chapter 1, Rav Yudin and Rav Levi are cited as saying in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Kol makom shenamar b'megillat Esther melech Ahasuerus, b'Ahasuerus hakatuv medaber, v'chol makom shenamar melech stam b'melech malchei hamlachim hakatuv medaber. Every place where it says the king Ahasuerus in Megillat Esther, it is talking about Ahasuerus. And every place it just says the king, it is talking about the king of all kings. We indicated that Esther realizes that Ahasuerus holds the power in the Persian Empire. She also realizes that there is one true power in the world who ultimately will decide the fate of the Jews. In this vein, the Gemara in Megillah on Tetvav Amud Bet 15b discusses the opening line of our chapter about the king's inability to sleep. Amar Rabbi Tanchum, Nadadashnat Malko Shel Olam. The true king of the world, meaning Hashem, was the one not sleeping. As an explanation for this opinion, Rashi on the Gemara cites Tehillim Ayin Chet Samach Hei, chapter 78, verse 65, which describes Hashem waking up as if he had been asleep to save his people from their enemies. The Gemara continues with the opinion of the rabbis, Nadadu El Yonim, Nadadu Tachtonim. There was unrest on high and below. Rashi suggests that the heavenly upheaval describes angels accusing Ahasuerus of being a kafoi tova, someone lacking in gratitude who needs to repay someone he owes, or perhaps the heavenly upheaval was in order to demand prayer from the lower realms. These opinions highlight the hidden role of Hashem in the otherwise improbable series of events which lead to the salvation of the Jews. Or as Rashi on Pasuk Aleph, verse 1 of the Megillah, here in chapter 6 succinctly sums it up by saying, Nes haya, it was a miracle. The Gemara continues, however, with the other side of the story, the success of Esther's strategy. Rava says, it is describing the sleep of Ahasuerus. He is up at night wondering why Esther invited Haman to their otherwise private party. It occurs to him that Haman and Esther may be plotting to kill him. Then he thinks, if that is so, is there no one in the kingdom who would clue him into this point? He then worries, maybe he hasn't rewarded someone who has saved him in the past, and that is why no one's sticking up for him now, and therefore asks that his chronicles be read to him. It just so happens, or perhaps it is not a coincidence at all, that the part of the book that is read that night is the story of Mordechai foiling the assassination plot against Ahasuerus, which we learned about in Chapter 2, Perek Bet. The king asks how Mordechai was rewarded for this act of loyalty, and his attendants answer that nothing was done. At that very moment, apparently perhaps having heard some noise, Ahasuerus asks who is in the courtyard. We are told that Haman had come to the outer courtyard of the king to tell the king to hang Mordechai. It is remarkable that Haman was so eager to follow his wife's advice that he ignores the part where she said to tell the king of his plans the next morning. Haman actually shows up outside the palace of a paranoid king in the middle of the night or very early in the morning. Yalkut Shimoni cites the opinion of Rabbi Yeshua ben Elai that Ahasuerus kept having nightmares with Haman standing over him with a sword drawn, forcing him to take off his royal garments and the crown from his head and trying to kill him. He wakes up from this dream, wondering how prescient it is to find Haman outside his door. When Ahasuerus is told by his attendants that it is Haman in the courtyard, the king instructs him to come in and asks Haman for advice. What shall be done for one whom the king wants to honor? Our arrogant and clueless Haman cannot imagine the king wanting to honor anyone other than himself. If we follow the line of thinking that Ahasuerus was quite suspicious of Haman at this point in time, we can imagine that this question of Ahasuerus may be a test of Haman's loyalty. If that is the case, Haman fails miserably. Haman suggests that this person be brought the king's royal clothes and horse, which has been ridden on by the king with the crown, straight out of Ahasuerus' nightmare. This clothing and horse should be given to one of the king's noble officers who will dress the person being honored and lead him on a horse throughout the city, proclaiming before him, "Kacha ye'aseh la'ish asher hamelech chafetz bikaro." So is done for the man who the king wishes to honor. It is interesting to note that in the continuation of Haman's suggestion, he drops talk of the crown and only mentions the clothing and the horse. Rashi suggests that the look on Ahasuerus' face when the crown was mentioned made it clear to Haman that he'd better drop that idea quickly. If we think about Haman's suggestion in the context of ancient kings, we can understand how wildly inappropriate it is. In another comparison to the Yosef story, which was first suggested to me by my wonderful 11th grade Nach teacher, Mrs. Rena Gopin-Wolf, we see that when Paro honors Yosef in Bereishit Perek Mem Aleph, chapter 41, Yosef is clearly second to the king. He is given fine linen garments, not the clothes of the king, and paraded around in the secondary chariot, not the king's own chariot. Indeed, if you look at Rambam's Mishneh Torah for laws regarding kings of Israel in Hilchot Melachim Bet Aleph, Laws of Kings, Chapter 2, Law 1, it is forbidden to ride on a king's horse, wear his crown, or use any of his things. With his suspicions confirmed, Ahasuerus has some fun at Haman's expense. In Pasuk Yud, verse 10, he tells Haman to quickly take the clothing and horse, kasher dibarta, as you said, reminding him that this was all his idea, v'aseichin l'Mordechai ha'Yehudi ha'yoshev b'shar ha'melech, and do this all for Mordechai, the Jew, who sits in the king's court, emphasizing everything Haman hates about Mordechai, that Jew who has the audacity to sit in the king's court and not bow to him. Ahasuerus then adds, al tapel davar mikol asher dibarta, do not leave out anything from all that you said. Instead of just telling us that Haman did as he was told, the following Pasuk Yud Aleph, verse 11, details Haman taking the clothing and the horse, dressing Mordechai, parading him through the streets of the city, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man whom the king wishes to honor. These repeated details highlight the pain and humiliation we can imagine Haman is experiencing. Pasuk Yud Bet, verse 12, indicates that afterwards, Mordechai returns to the king's court. It seems as if nothing special has happened. But Haman is pushed to his house, avel v'chafoi rosh, in mourning with his head covered. Ibn Ezra suggests Haman covered his head, presumably in shame. Rashi refers us to the rabbi's opinion in Masechet Megillah without elaborating on the opinion. Referring to the story on Tetzayin Amud Aleph, 16a, of Haman's daughter seeing the scene of Haman parading Mordechai around from the roof of Haman's home, and assuming it was the opposite, Mordechai leading Haman, and with that assumption, she empties the chamber pot on Haman's head. When Haman looks up and she realizes she has done this to her father, She falls off the roof and dies. Hence the expression Avel, mourning for his daughter, and Chafoy Rosh, literally covered in excrement, a very graphic description of how Haman's day was going. At this point, Haman returns home looking for comfort and seeks out first his wife, who had given him the advice to have Mordechai killed, and then his loved ones, in Pasuk Yud Gimel, verse 13. Dat Mikra points out the parallel language between Haman describing Et Kol Asher Karahu, all that had happened to him, here in chapter 6, and those same words used back in chapter 4 when Mordechai tells Esther in verse 7, Et Kol Asher Karahu, all that had happened to him, referring to the decree against the Jews, indicating another reversal from Mordechai crying out bitterly in the center of the city to Mordechai being paraded around the city by Haman, who is now in mourning. The response to Haman in our chapter 6, verse 13, comes from Chachamav v'Zeresh Ishto, his wise ones and Zeresh's wife. In this verse, Zeresh is back to being the second one listed. We can imagine her slinking to the back of the crowd with her realization that her advice is not going remotely as planned. It is also interesting to note that the term for the rest of Haman's household switches from Ohavav, his loved ones, to Chachamav, his wise ones, likely because their response is not very loving. They tell him, Im mizera Yehudim Mordechai, asher hachilota linpol lefanav lo tuchalo ki nafolti pol lefanav. If Mordechai is amongst the descendants of the Jews, now that you have begun to fall before him, you will not prevail over him, but rather will surely fall before him. In the middle of this conversation, officers of the king arrive to rush Haman off to the second party Esther is making for the king and him, and so the chapter ends. In Perek Vav, chapter 6, we have seen the description of events unfolding without direct reference to Hashem's role, in a way that has far too many fortuitous coincidences to believe that all is truly happening by chance. We noticed how Esther's plan is working in that the king is becoming increasingly suspicious of Haman, that Haman's ego and ambition blind him into playing right into Esther's hand, and that the details, such as Ahasuerus reading about Mordechai saving his life exactly at the moment when Haman shows up to ask to kill Mordechai, highlight the hidden role of Hashem in the well-timed lineup of events leading up to the reversal of the fate of the Jews. We had mentioned when learning chapter 5 that Ibn Ezra indicates that Esther was waiting for a sign from Hashem before proceeding with her plan to beg Ahasuerus for the lives of her people. If so, the events of this very unpleasant day for Haman could very well be the sign she is waiting for, giving her the courage to follow through in tomorrow's chapter, Perek Zayin, chapter 7. Thank you for studying together in the memory of our beloved father and grandfather, Ted Ordin, Mordechai ben Ephraim v'Miriam Golda, in commemoration of his 10th Yortzeit. His family is forever grateful for his devotion to family, vision, courage, and optimism. May the merit of our collective learning elevate his neshama and bring unity and peace to Klal Yisrael. Helen and Moshe Sassever and family.